good to be home. Home is where the heart is. But I confess that it's good to travel. It's good to break from the routines of the year. It's particularly valuable to expose yourself to other traditions, other cultures, whose ways are variant from your own. Because in so doing, inevitably, you pass in review in your own mind the basic assumptions of your own life. All of us are faced every day with problems to which we respond instinctively. We take the armory of our commitments from the world about us, from our home, from our community. But are the cultural attitudes of Cleveland, of the United States, of Jewish life, the inevitable ones, the inexorable ones, the correct ones? And of course, there is no world more different from our own than that of the fabled subcontinent of India. No place which makes you ask more often, is their way right, or is ours? What have they to teach that we have to learn? What have we to teach that they might well learn? When we decided to go to India, I was asked again and again, why of all God-forsaken places, India? And I was told all kinds of terrible tales about the difficulty of traveling far away. And they're all true. You have to boil your water. You can't even brush your teeth without special preparation. You often go to the airport and with your ticket in hand and the schedule in your pocket, only to find that the plane's going in the other direction and on a different day. You find yourself in very primitive quarters, and sometimes the sanitation is not only primitive, but non-existent. But with it all, a visit to India is one of the most meaningful of exposures that a Westerner can have. Because their attitudes towards life, their traditional scheme of values, is at a tangent, a 90-degree angle from our own. They do things differently. Above our ark, we have inscribed the commandments, and the second commandment is not to make any graven image, nor any manner of likeness. And the Jews taught the West in time to obey these commandments, and idolatry in the religious sense has been absent from Western thought for many centuries. But in India, men bow the knee every day to personified gods. Animism, fetishism, totemism are part of the way of life. Shiva, Vishnu, Ganesh, a whole series of gods are worshipped in their shrines. And each of the gods has his own image, and the image is a statue, an icon, an idol, and the image is venerated and sacrificed too. What difference does it make to a people inside, in their own spiritual makeup, when they continue to worship the gods rather than the one God, the image of God, is Babo, rather than the spirit, the nature of God itself? And more than this, almost all Indians are united by a basic philosophy which one can only call a philosophy of resignation, fatalism. We teach our young people by word and by deed to be active, to be vigorous, to be up and doing, to be committed, to be socially concerned, to be involved in the common weal. The yoga, the guru, the swami, the Indian parent teaches his young largely to transcend the cares of the everyday, to withdraw, to draw unto himself, to realize that the only real world is the inner world, and the only real fulfillment, the peace of mind which comes from not allowing oneself to care too deeply about anything. We say life is a blessing. They say life is a burden. We say go out and conquer. They say turn in and develop all the special self-controls. One of the great classic texts of Hinduism is the Bhagavad Gita. It's a short book read by almost all Indians who can read. It was written in the early pre-Christian centuries and purports to be the admonitions of Lord Krishna to a young prince who was forced to rethink all of the values of his life because he was placed in need of struggling against his own family to keep his throne. And in the Bhagavad Gita, you find this kind of sentiment again and again and again. He who abandons all desires, he who acts free without longing, without any sense of self, attains to peace. What would we do to a school system which destroyed the sense of self in our children? We want them to become themselves. We talk always of individuality, of knowing oneself, being true to oneself. In India, the self stands in the way of peace. The self is selfish. The self has desires. Desires tie you into the world. The world is beguiling. The world is misleading. You must scissor away these ties and break these bonds if you're to attain the peace of mind. Now, to a Westerner who has been drenched in the flood of salesmanship, of public relations and advertising of our materialistic society, the teachings of India, the teachings which say the more a person has, the more he wants. There is no end to desire. The more you climb the greasy pole, the harder it is to climb further, and you never quite reach the top. But more to a Westerner, the teachings of non-desire, of turning away from the beguilements of the world, are at first blush terribly appealing. And a modern visitor to India finds at almost every turn a few young people from Western Europe, from the United States, who have gone to India to seek enlightenment, to find a value, a lifestyle at variance with, completely different from that of the American community. Will they find enlightenment? I watched one young boy on a beach in central India walk along that beach into the sunset. He was hypnotized by the sun. He was mumbling some kind of Hindu incantation. He was fingering the prayer bead. He seemed terribly lost and terribly lonely, and I was terribly, terribly sorry for him. He was a young man in search. His search said something about the misplaced values within our own society. But whether India holds the answer, I could not tell. He walked into the sunset, and he disappeared. What I'd like to do this morning is simply to think aloud with you, reflect on some of my experiences, to mull over some feelings that I had during this trip. Perhaps you will share them with me. Perhaps you'll understand their basis. I hope so. India is, as we all know, synonymous with poverty. Poverty in India is a quantitative phenomenon. Poverty is palpable. You feel it, you smell it, you taste it, you can't avoid it. It's all around you. Every night in Calcutta, 500,000 people go to sleep on the sidewalks. They live, they cook, they sleep, they procreate in the open on the streets of the city. India is a country which is 80% rural. 80% of India, 8 in 10 people, live in some of the 600,000 villages of India, and they live largely in the simplest of huts, thatch covered. They sleep on the floor, they sleep with the animals, and in the monsoon season, the floor becomes a quagmire of mud, and the roof, like as not, blows away. Only 2 of the 10 who live in these cities owns land. The rest are tenant farmers, sharecroppers. whose eke out a marginal existence between what they must pay for seed and what they must pay for rent and what they must pay in taxes. And when the drought comes, and when the harvest is slim, they starve. And while we were in India, in Rajasthan, one of the provinces in the north which borders on the desert between India and Pakistan, an area which has been plagued by drought for these many months, one community became so desperate that it actually sacrificed a 14-year-old boy to the angry rain god Indra. India is a country in which families of the untouchables, the poor, still deliberately maim their youngsters, cripple them or blind them, in order that they can have the mat within 5 steps of the temple in the city, which has been traditionally that of the family where the alms are dropped by those who go to the temple. Now, what we call poverty in the United States, HUF, is many, many, many steps above poverty in India. Poverty in India is abject. It is total. It is a way of life which has been going on from generation to generation. The average income of the Indian family is $93 a year. We call the poor in America, a family of four who have an income of less than $4,000 a year. The poor in India are illiterate, they lack sanitation, they lack healing, therapy, physicians. They live in the narrowest of surroundings within their village. They never leave it. They live always on the edge of death and of disease. They live relatively without hope. And yet they live with a decency, a sense of personal cleanliness, a lack of frustration, which is incredible to anyone trained in the West. For in India, there has long been a theology, an ideology, if you will, a religion, which has established a rationalization for, which has developed an explanation of, which has justified the poverty which has been endemic for so many centuries. It's the law of reincarnation. It's the doctrine of karma. It's a doctrine which says, in essence, you are born into a particular family, into a particular class, into a particular station in life, not by chance, but because you deserve to be born into this particular family, in this particular caste, and this particular occupation, because of your actions in some previous existence. And your purpose in life is not to struggle against your fate. You deserve it. Your purpose in life is to live with such self-discipline, such rectitude, such character, such concern with the rules of the faith, that you will merit in your next life a much higher and better birth. And as a result, men do not struggle as does man in the West against what we call the indignity of poverty. Men tend to accept it, to be passive and submissive to it, to seek rather to regulate their lives within it so that it won't happen to them again. And the converse of that is that the wealth in India, and there is great wealth among a very, very few, the wealth of India have almost no social sense, social concern. Their wealth, their status, their caste comes to them because of their quality in a previous existence. They deserve it. And the poor deserve their poverty. Therefore, the United Appeal and the United Jewish Appeal has no counterpart, a United Indian Appeal. Therefore, conspicuous display and conspicuous consumption go hand in hand with the most abysmal and utter poverty. No one seems to feel great compunction about it, except the bright young people of India, who've been raised in the schools which the English planted throughout the country, some of whom have been trained abroad in the best schools of the West or in the Soviet who have learned to look at their society with other eyes, and who find the analysis of Karl Marx terribly compelling. For Marx, you recall, taught that many societies, all societies in his mind, use religion as an opiate for the masses, to keep the masses passive and quiet and non-rebellious. By promising some future bliss, they make them quiescent against the indignities of today, of the everyday. And that's precisely what the young say has happened in India. And that's precisely what the young university graduate rebels against, and why India is no longer a great monolithic society, all of whose parts tend to agree with certain cultural preconceptions. India is today two worlds. India today reminds you of the butterfly as it shakes its way, tries to shake its way out of the imprisoning cocoon. On the one hand, there is primitivism and poverty in the tens of millions. On the other hand, while we were in India, the first atomic power generator was set in motion. On the other hand, there are plants in India which produce today transistors, and television sets, and jet airplanes, and railroad cars, all the goods of modern society. On the one hand, there are villages in India, countless thousands of them, where life has not changed for the last 1,000 years. And on the other hand, there is in India a Bombay or a Calcutta or a Delhi or a Madras, great modern cities run by businessmen and engineers and technicians and bankers who have been trained at the Graduate School of Business at Harvard, at the Sorbonne, at Oxford, who speak the language our professionals speak and who understand all of the sophistications and all of the subtleties of Western finance and of Western science. India is a society which seems to be going two ways at once. Towards us, towards the industrial and technical revolution, and yet being held back, being restrained by the ancient history, by the problems of the day. And what India does, how it solves this problem, this crisis of values, this change, will in a very major way affect the history of the world. Because one of the things that we tend to forget about India is that it represents 1/6 of the population of the globe. 1 in every 6 human beings is an Indian. By the last United Nations census, there were something on the order of 530 million Indian citizens. What India does, what India becomes, the ideology that India adopts will obviously in a major way affect the balance of power between the competing ideologies of the world. Where will India go? To give you a sense of the size of India, while we were in the country, there was a great debate as to the future of India as a viable nation. For the last 2,000 years, really, India has never been one country. It has been a series of competing kingdoms, maharajadoms, if there's such a word, series of competing little city-states and provinces. Even under England in the last 200 years, there was never such a thing as one India. There was a central area which England governed directly, and there were many little separate states in the Punjab and elsewhere which were governed directly by their maharajas and their kings. The Congress Party in India, the party of Gandhi and of Nehru and of Indira Gandhi, the president and prime minister, has ruled in India since independence from England 22 years ago. It represents centralization. But in the last 6 months, as you've been reading, the Congress Party is split in two. And there's great political confusion in the land. And there's the beginning of what the political scientists call devolution, a growing emphasis on provincialism. Each state in India seems to be demanding greater and greater autonomy. Many of the states have their own language. Each has its own separate ethnic composition. Some states are largely Muslim, some states are largely Hindu, one state is largely Sikh, and so on. Now, if this were to take place, and I doubt frankly that it will, but if it were to take place, only one of the states of India, Andhra Pradesh, in the central Deccan Highlands, would at that moment, at the moment which it became a nation, be the sixth most populous nation in the world. India is not a curiosity. India is not a fabled land which is somehow disconnected with the rest of the world. Perhaps it's been for a time. But it's very much a part of our world. And the answers that it finds as it moves into the 20th century, the allegiances that it makes, will in a very major way determine the balance of power, which will affect all of our lives. Which way will India go? Which way should she go? We assume that the city, the machine, the transistor, instantaneous communication, penicillin, all the valuables of modern science represent the wave of the future. And indeed, they do contribute, do they not, to our abundance, to our health, to our ability to survive. But they do much else. They create a ruthless urban proletariat. They create an educated class which has no craft and no skill. They create needs and appetites which cannot be satisfied. Which way shall India go? What does medicine represent to India? Modern medicine represents to India the difference between a lifespan of an average of 29 years at the turn of the century to a lifespan of nearly 50 years today. Medicine represents the end to most of the communicable diseases and the plagues which can be inoculated against and immunized against. Medicine is great, a blessing, a good. Medicine represents the reason that India has doubled her population in the last 70 years. The reason that for all the change that has taken place, for all the new factories, for the green revolution which has brought more abundance to the harvest, for all of the money which has been plowed in and the time, the sacrifice and the concern, tens of millions and hundreds of millions still go to bed every night without enough in their bellies. India increases in population by the equivalent of the entire continent of Australia every single year. How do you provide sufficiency? How do you make a land which must be brought back into cultivation, which must be irrigated, which must be redesigned? How do you make such a land provide for this vast number of people, multiplying, multiplying, and multiplying again? Medicine is a blessing. The blessing is also a curse. And what's true of medicine is true of education. India is committed, like the Jewish people, to learning. You're impressed as you go through India, not by the great brand new glass and brick schools, which you don't see except in the major cities, but by the fact that every little village, every slum, has a little tent area with a few poles and a few bits of torn canvas to keep out the sun and the occasional rain, under which the children sit day after day after day and repeat the lessons of the teacher. Now, learning is primitive. It's largely by rote, by repetition. If you pick up, as we often did, a textbook in a subject that you know something about, you'll find that it's a lot of their learning is simply disconnected knowledge, facts which don't fit together. But suddenly, a people is being educated. They're being trained in the attitudes of other cultures. They're learning about communism and about capitalism, about agnosticism, and about all the values of the West. And what does this mean? It means, in the first instance, that the universities of India are graduating hundreds of young people for which there are at present no jobs. The midterm graduations were taking place while we were in India, and again and again and again, the university speaker who got up to give the graduating commencement address was heckled and shouted down by young people who said, "We want jobs, not speeches." India is simply not geared up to provide opportunity for the technician and for the engineer in such numbers.
But more than this, more basic. What do you do with a young person in a small farming community who learns to read, who learns to write, who learns to cipher, who is exposed to other values beyond those of his family and his traditional craft and his traditional skill, who reads about all the allurements and the enticements of the city, all the opportunities of modern civilization, who becomes therefore restless with the old ways, who will not learn the ancient craft of his clan, who will not go out and work in the fields as has his father and his father's father, who then gravitates as a relatively unskilled person to Calcutta or to Bombay or to some other city, who seeks to find employment, who finds none, or if he finds a job, he finds that though he is no longer the workhorse that his father was, he is now a wage slave, who has less in real income than did his father, and worse than this, who has broken loose of the community which was the village, and is now rootless, uprooted, alien, a stranger among his own. For with all of its superstition, for all of its misery, for all of its poverty, an Indian rural village is a community. It's separated by caste, it's separated by class. There are the rich and the poor, there are the literate and the illiterate, but each one is in a well-known relationship with the other. And for all of the pressures which the extended family exerts against the individuality of any one member, it also protects him and gives him succor. And gives him encouragement when he needs it. But when he's adrift and alone, who will save him? What will be his values? How will he find happiness? Where lies his future? And when you travel in a city like Calcutta today, you're impressed not only by the huddled rags sleeping on the street, but by the restless mob, the hundreds and thousands of workers who are constantly roiling to find themselves, to get better wages, to get better hours, but they can't be given to them. So they are at war with the society. They are tearing the city apart. Calcutta today is a violent city. It's a city which may not survive. Businesses are simply closing their doors and leaving. Why? Because it's filled with this restless urban proletariat, unskilled or semi-skilled, for which jobs cannot be found, who have no sense of belonging, who have no sense of what their own values are or who they are, and who are therefore rolling stones who must inevitably bump into and crash down on someone else. You wonder as you go through India, how India is going to survive the economic and industrial transformation which is beginning throughout the country. You wonder how the individual, the family, the marriage, the basic relationships of life will survive. And then you look back and reflect upon your own nation and you realize that you really don't have too much to teach. We too have not been that successful. Despite our centuries of experience with industry and with the city, and finding ways of giving amenity to life, decency to life, and dignity to the life within the urban environment. The one thing that you are convinced of is this, that India is going to go through a series of traumatic crises, perhaps of revolution, before she can begin really to deal with the problems of the new world. And the one hope probably is this, that the ancient teachings about restraint, passivity, nonviolence, will somehow find effective forms of translation to the new generation and will temper their anger and temper their bitterness so that they will take vengeance not against their society, but only against its evil. That they will not destroy themselves and their world in trying to create a new world. What else does India lead to in your thinking? A great deal of anger. not against the Indian whom you meet. He's a sensitive, very, very hospitable, quite decent human being by and large, but against his progenitors who have created the situation from which he suffers today. The thing that that became clearer and clearer to me as we went through India was this. All of this poverty need not have happened. 4,000 years ago, at the dawn of civilization, the Indus River Valley in northwest India was one of the great centers in which the city life first emerged. And the archaeologists who have dug in Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa and the other great cities of this culture, cities which are the equivalent of Sumer and Akkad and Memphis and Thebes, have found that the people who lived there knew about city planning, they knew about sewage, they had great decent homes, green spaces, and surrounding their cities they had parks and forests and finely irrigated fields and villages. India was a rich country. There was jungle, there was forest, there were the rivers who brought water to the plains, the land was rich. The sun and the land, and the monsoons were generous. The land could produce two crops a year. There was enough for everyone. The trees bound by their roots, the topsoil to the earth. The land could provide all that a nation required, and there was buried beneath the land all the mineral resource that a modern nation would have needed. We learn in our history texts that when Alexander the Great conquered the world, he went as far as the Indus Valley, and then he said, the world is mine. What we do not learn in our history texts is when he turned back from the farther bank of the Indus, he faced on the other side a Mauryan king by the name of Chandragupta, who ruled an empire larger than that of Alexander's, and equal in Alexander's in every level of culture and of amenity and of scientific attainment. India began with every possibility that America now enjoys. What India is today is not a testament to God's niggardliness, but to man's greed, to the short-sightedness of kings. Throughout India, you see the remnants of great tanks and irrigation systems, which were forsaken and forgotten as kingdom warred against kingdom for some crown jewel, for some city, or some princess. The forest was denuded as settlers cut it down for the wood and failed to plant again. The earth was planted and planted seed time and harvest twice each year without any being refertilized, without being allowed to lie fallow. There was never a thought to the future. And modern India is dotted with and almost overwhelmed by ruins. I visited a city called Fatehpur Sikri. It's a city which is 16 miles square within the walls. The palace, the great Mughal emperor Akbar, who built Fatehpur Sikri, is a mile square. It's in perfect care. You could move into it today if you could afford to staff a home that's a mile square. The city was lived in for 23 years, and then it was abandoned. They came. They built this great empire. They farmed the fields about. They built canals. The king was ambitious, and he failed to pay attention to what was happening close at hand, and the land quickly failed to produce the harvest, and there was not enough to feed the people. And so the king and his court and the people moved on 100 miles down towards Agra and built there another capital. And Fatehpur Sikri can be duplicated and triplicated throughout India. The rape of the environment, pollution, carelessness, all that we are reading about now about the United States occurred in India and is India's tragedy and can be our own. It can happen. Because the laws of nature are immutable. Because a society which is more concerned with somebody else's wealth than with the wealth of the earth which seeks only the good of the moment but does not seek to build for its children and its children's children. Society which beclouds the rivers and pollutes the air and begrimes the countryside and destroys the forests and reverses the natural ecology of things, such a society for all its power. The Chandragupta and the Mauryans had great power, the power to stop Alexander. Such a society dooms itself. I read while I was in India several of the articles which have appeared in the local magazines about the environmental crisis. And reading them, as you live among the proof of the concern which man must have for his environment, is quite different than reading them here in Cleveland, where it seems to be far away, where there's always food on the table, where there's always another meal, or we can think of moving farther out into the countryside to escape from the smog and the dirt and the crime and the filth. But believe me, my friends, America must not become an India. It need not. But it's on its way. I reminded myself as I traveled through India of an old midrash. Creation, God took Adam and Eve and brought them up to a high cliff from which they could look out upon the entire world. And he said to them, here's your world. Here's the greenness of the forest. And here's the grain in the field. And here's the blue of the clean rivers. And here's the warmth and the light of the sun. Here's all that you need. Go out now and husband it. India reminds us that this law, go out and husband the earth, remains the first requirement of man. One who comes back from India feels himself doubly and committed to any and all schemes which can perhaps preserve this good earth for the coming generations. Amen.